Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday the 3rd of February, these are our main stories. Police in London shoot dead a man wearing a hoax explosive device who'd stabbed passers-by in what's being called an Islamist terror attack. As fears rise about the coronavirus, China injects $170 billion into the economy. An Iranian court hands down long jail sentences to dissidents who called for the country's supreme leader to stand down. Also in this podcast, Somalia declares a national emergency as it tries to deal with huge swarms of locusts, which are threatening food supplies. And voters in the US state of Iowa prepare to vote on the Democrat who will stand against President Trump.
I've seen Booker, Gabbard, Warren, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and now Yang. So a lot.
Do you have a favorite?
Yeah. I think it changes every day.
It's emerged that a man who was shot dead by British police after stabbing people on a busy London street on Sunday had recently been released from prison for terrorism offences. Police say the man was wearing a fake explosive device. The attack happened in the South London area of Streatham. Three people were taken to hospital. One has serious injuries. This woman was in the area at the time.
I heard that there was a shooting, that somebody was stabbing people and they have to shoot him.
And what else?
Nothing more.
How many shots did you hear?
Three shots.
And what happened then? What did you do?
I just ran for my life.
Kaka Tahir was working at a nearby barber's shop. He described what he saw.
A young male wearing something they say was a vest, and behind him three plainclothes police officers with the gun. There was a pistol. And this plain officer, you didn't even expect the police. Until they shot him, they bring their uniform stuff, then you realize that a police officer. I hear three shot, and I see him how he dropped, and he was alive for good 2-3 minutes on the floor. The armed police arrive as well. This is where they say, you got to move because there's a bomb there, it may explode. We have to leave, so we had to evacuate from the back of the shop.
The police have now named the man, as we heard from our correspondent at the scene, Duncan Kennedy.
We've now had confirmation of the man's name. He is Sudesh Aman. We now know that Sudesh Aman, the man involved, was released from prison at the end of January. He'd been serving 3 years for terrorist-related offences, and as is his right, he was released about halfway through that jail sentence, about 18 months, at the end of last month. And that is why we now know that he was under surveillance by plainclothes police officers. Then come to today's events. Mr. Aman was being under surveillance by plainclothes police officers. There's some kind of incident about half a mile from where we're standing. Events then move to where I'm standing, where the stabbings take place. And that's why and how the police are able to intervene so quickly, because they've been following this man. For some reason, he's got hold of a knife, whether it's from a shop, as some reports suggest, or whether he's carrying it himself. He starts attacking people with this knife, stabbing very seriously a man and a woman. The man has life-threatening injuries. Almost as soon as that happens, the police step in and shoot him. Eyewitnesses talk of having heard three shots involved. The man is lying on the pavement, where he's later declared dead. Police declare a terrorist incident immediately and also reveal that the man has Islamist connections. They're not going into any more detail than that. So this is not a random police presence here. It's not some chance encounter with this man by police officers. He was under surveillance, having been released from prison in the last couple of weeks or so.
Duncan Kennedy, and just as we were recording this podcast, police have released a statement saying that the seriously injured person is no longer in a life-threatening condition. The Chinese authorities will open a military-led field hospital on Monday to help treat people stricken by the new coronavirus. It took engineers just 10 days to build it in Wuhan, the epicentre of the outbreak, in an effort to ease the pressure on the city's hospitals, which have been overwhelmed by the scale of the crisis. More than 300 people are now known to have died from the disease in China. This report from our correspondent in Beijing, John Sudworth.
As a man sobs in a hospital ward, he's asked, "Who's died?" "My father," comes the reply. Just outside, 8 body bags are counted. These unverified social media videos appear to show a city and a health system overwhelmed. Ningxi Xu, visiting Wuhan from the US, says her sick relatives can't even get into hospital.
The hospital staff just told them that they could not perform the test. I think it's because of a capacity issue. So I think the official statistics are a lot more deflated compared to what the reality actually is.
China's trying to show the world it's coping, building a brand new hospital in Wuhan in just 10 days. But it's now clear that in the early stages, chances were missed, whistleblowers censored and information withheld. The massive stimulus package just announced is a sign that this is not just a human catastrophe, but an economic one too.
John Sudworth. Well, as fears rise about the financial impact of the virus, China's central bank has announced that it's to inject more than $170 billion into the economy. For more on the economic repercussions of the coronavirus, I turn to our business correspondent, Katie Prescott.
One China economist I spoke to said that we could see 2 percentage points cut off economic growth in China in the first part of this year. And that's why we've seen the Bank of China today saying that they're going to put money into the system, put money into the banks to protect businesses that have been threatened by the virus, and also to encourage businesses that work in medical supplies, for example, that are trying to fight off the virus.
Because even before this coronavirus outbreak, there had been concerns about China's slowing economy. And what we're looking at from the Bank of China is possibly the largest cash injection ever.
That's right, the largest cash injection since records began. And this comes right off the back, of course, of the US-China trade war, which has also limited China's economic growth and scared investors about global economic growth, because China's responsible for 20% of the world's GDP. So when you start to see a slowdown in China or China's connectivity with the rest of the world starting to be limited, that's bound to have an effect on other countries.
Because we've talked in the past about whenever America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And lots of people are very worried about possibly the same happening with China.
It's an unfortunate analogy to use, isn't it? But that's absolutely right. And we have seen financial markets in other parts of the world down this week. And as you say, we're expecting to see financial markets in China take a hit as well. Some people have drawn a parallel with SARS, the outbreak that happened in 2004. But the Chinese economy is now 6 times larger than it was during that outbreak. And so the world's reliance on China is just that much greater now. And it's very hard to find a business that, even if they don't deal directly with China, they're very likely to have someone in their supply chain who does, or a client who does. And so that's the real worry. If factories in China are closing down, where are people sourcing their products from? And then also, if you're looking at the Chinese consumer and their demand, if that isn't there, that's bound to have a knock-on effect on businesses.
Katie Prescott. A court in Iran has sentenced 8 people to a total of 72 years in prison for writing an open letter calling on the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei to step down. Kazra Naji from BBC Persian reports.
The sentences by a court in the city of Mashhad in northeast Iran are harsh even by Iranian standards. The court had found the 8, who are all well-known dissidents, guilty of disparaging the state and forming an illegal group. They still face further charges, including disturbing public peace and insulting Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. They were among a group of 14 dissidents who wrote an open letter last June saying there was no point in engaging with the government as the despotic rule of the leader had made it impossible to negotiate any reform. The Supreme Leader has on many occasions said he welcomes criticism of his rule, but the sentences show that in reality there is little room for dissent and particularly any criticism of him.
Kazranaji. Already suffering from food shortages due to successive droughts and flooding, not to mention an unstable security situation, Somalia has now been beset by an infestation of locusts. The government has called it a national emergency. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says a locust invasion in the Horn of Africa is the worst in a quarter of a century. A week ago, our senior Africa reporter Anne Soy described what she saw in neighbouring northern Kenya.
There are thousands and thousands of locusts flying. I'm trying not to say this, but the formation looks beautiful. These creatures are tiny and they look harmless. But if you consider that hundreds of millions of them are flying at the same time, the amount of destruction they cause is huge. Any moment now, they will be finding a place to rest. That will be on trees, on vegetation, where they will feed before they start flying again.
Our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper, told me more.
The situation in Somalia is really appalling. It's been going on for weeks now. They've had this infestation of locusts. And the problem with Somalia is it's a country that has so many other problems. It has been in a state of conflict for 30 years. It's also suffered successive droughts. And then late last year, it also suffered from tremendous flooding, which is what's actually contributed to the presence of the locusts. So you imagine a country that's already on its knees, basically, now being threatened by yet another problem, locusts. And it's not just threatening the people, who obviously depend on agriculture, but also Somalia is an economy that's highly dependent on livestock, lots of camels and goats in particular, and sheep. And they are going to face a lot of problems because they won't have enough pasture to graze on.
Now that the Somali government has declared a national emergency, what difference will that make in practice?
In practice, it's going to be very difficult for the Somali government to do anything at all without external help. It is pretty much confined to the capital Mogadishu and has control over a few other towns and a few rural areas in Somalia. But as it doesn't even, its authority doesn't stretch very far and it has very limited resources, unless it's going to get help from the outside world, it's difficult to imagine what it's going to do. It's possible that it's made this announcement in a way to sort of get world attention focused to see if it can get any outside assistance.
And it's not just Somalia that's affected by the locusts.
No, it stretches across the whole region. The whole of Ethiopia is also very badly affected, Eritrea, northern Kenya and other parts of the world as well, including Pakistan. But what's particularly difficult about the Somali situation is that because there's so much insecurity, one way that the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations says is the sort of best way to try to tackle locusts is with spraying insecticides from planes. But you can't do that in Somalia because there's all these armed groups, particularly Al-Shabaab, the Islamist Al-Qaeda affiliated group, that just make it impossible to fly crop spraying planes over the territory. So it's almost like they don't know what to do. I mean, they're resorting to the most desperate measures to try to frighten them away, like beating pots and pans or even shooting at them in the air. But that is really not having much effect at all.
Mary Harper. Still to come, we hear how a new Arabic version of Sesame Street aims to help children fleeing war deal with their emotions.
The show demonstrates strategies like belly breathing, fun songs and games around ways that they can calm themselves, how they can develop emotional regulation skills.
And we hear who's won the BAFTA Film Awards. Democratic candidates vying to become their party's nominee for the US presidency are making their closing pitches in Iowa, where the state-by-state selection process begins later on Monday. Hundreds of thousands of Iowan Democrats are expected to turn out to nominate the person they want to take on Donald Trump in November's presidential election. Neda Tofik is in the state capital, Des Moines.
Well, there have been a string of rallies across the state today, the last day of campaigning. Right now, I'm at a Pete Buttigieg rally, the mayor of South South Bend, Indiana. And recent polls are showing that this is an extremely tight race. They put Vice President Joe Biden head-to-head with Senator Bernie Sanders, really showing there a clash between whether Democrats want a moderate or progressive to lead them. And then we have Pete Buttigieg climbing up the polls, followed by Elizabeth Warren. So this is really anybody's game. And voters here in Iowa take their responsibility as the first contest very, very seriously.
Judy McCoy Davis is out bright and early, knocking on doors, canvassing for Joe Biden in an affluent area of Des Moines. There's just one more day of campaigning before Iowans will gather at caucus sites to nominate their candidate. And with such a competitive race this year, every voter counts.
And I was wondering if you were planning to go to the caucus.
Judy has worked on all three of Biden's past failed campaigns, but she believes this is his time.
He has the ability to work to actually get legislation passed, and that's what he is so good at.
Who do you think's not good at that?
I don't think Bernie Sanders is good at that.
He's rising in the polls. He's neck to neck with Joe Biden.
But they're not looking at the fact that in his years, he's never been able to build a coalition. He's always been that outsider, that independent.
There has been a frenzy of rallies across the state. In North Liberty, a city in eastern Iowa, former Vice President Joe Biden said he had the best chance to beat Donald Trump.
Folks, I think it's pretty simple. They don't want me to be the nominee because they know I'll beat him like a drum.
I am the ideal candidate for this job because the opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian man who likes that.
One candidate hoping to pull off a surprise in Iowa is Andrew Yang. The businessman and entrepreneur has focused on the changing economy and providing a universal basic income to all American adults. At his rally in a hotel in Des Moines, several voters were still torn about whom to support. In fact, more than a third of voters in Iowa are undecided.
I've seen Booker, Gabbard, Warren, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and now Yang. So a lot.
Do you have a favorite?
Yeah. I think it changes every day.
This is the best field I've ever seen. I mean, there's so many good candidates here.
So the overwhelming number of candidates doesn't bother
you? Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I like seeing women there. I really like Amy Klobuchar, too. We went and saw Warren. I was impressed with her. How can you not love Bernie? My main concern is getting Trump out of office.
Dennis Goldford is a longtime political analyst.
The key thing in understanding the significance of the caucuses is not so much any particular number as rather the question of expectations. Who does better than expected? Who does worse than expected? But say if someone like Amy Klobuchar, who's been hanging out in the distant fifth for quite some time, were to show up in second or even third, that would be the big story of the caucuses, even if she didn't come in first.
The caucus in the Hawkeye State will test the candidate's appeal and organizing capabilities. Still, it's the first contest of many along the way to the nomination.
That report by Neda Tofik. Mexican police are investigating a second death related to a world-famous monarch butterfly sanctuary in the western state of Michoacán. The body of Raul Hernandez, a tour guide at the UN World Heritage Site, was found 2 days after the burial of a well-known environmentalist, Homero Gómez. Prosecutors believe both were murdered. Our Latin America regional editor, Candice Piat, reports.
Both Raul Hernandez and Homero Gómez had worked for years to protect the forest visited each year by millions of monarch butterflies from the US and Canada, overwintering in Mexico's warmer climate. They'd spoken out many times against illegal logging and the expansion of avocado plantations into the butterfly sanctuary. The World Heritage Site attracts thousands of tourists each year, and replanting projects and tourism had begun to provide alternative sources of wealth for local communities. We may never know what happened to these two activists. Their deaths may be related to police and state corruption or to the operations of Michoacán's drug cartels.
Candice Peart. Millions of children have been robbed of their childhoods since the Syrian war broke out 9 years ago. Many have been refugees all their lives. Now Sesame Street, the fun TV educational show, has launched a new Arabic version to try to help those children. The show is produced in Jordan and has been devised in collaboration with child development specialists. Oliver Conway reports.
In its 50 years on TV, Sesame Street has talked about many difficult issues, divorce, racism, AIDS and autism, always in a child-friendly way. Now the programme is trying to help the 2.5 million children displaced by the war in Syria. In Ahlan Simsim, or Welcome Sesame, Cookie Monster, Elmo and other well-known puppets are joined by two new characters, Basma and Jad, who will explore some of the difficulties experienced by refugees. Katie Murphy, early childhood specialist at the International Rescue Committee, worked with Sesame Workshop on the new programme. She says initially it aims to help youngsters recognise and deal with their emotions.
The show demonstrates strategies like belly breathing, fun songs and games around ways that they can calm themselves, how they can develop emotional regulation skills through the wonderful characters of the Muppets. Conflict is addressed head-on in child-friendly ways, looking at interpersonal conflicts that occur between the characters, understanding that characters may feel a loss of, you know, sense of place for the character who's coming from a different neighborhood or different part of the world.
Lessons from the show will be reinforced by local parenting and preschool services in the region itself. The hope is that Ahlan Simsim will allow children in the Middle East who've experienced trauma and chaos at a young age to have a better chance of a normal life.
Oliver Conway. This year's BAFTA Awards, the British Film Academy Awards, took place at the Royal Albert Hall in London. Joker, The Irishman and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood were among the nominees for Best Film, but it was Sam Mendes' war drama 1917 that won the award. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd told me about the big winners.
1917 really says it all. Best film, best British film, which is a separate category. I always feel it's a bit of a shame when it goes to the same film, but there we are. Best director and inevitably best cinematography for Roger Deakins plus three others. The filming, of course, everyone goes on and on about the fact that it's filmed very nearly as if it's shot all in one go. So a massive technical achievement.
As co-writer of this film, I was involved from a very early stage, and I got to witness firsthand how quintessentially British 1917 was. We wrote 1917 to tell the story of a war which shaped the very fabric of our society and the unbelievable bravery of those who fought in it. So thank you. Thank you very much.
So that was Christy Wilson-Cairns, who's the co-writer of 1917. Good, I think, that actually Sam Mendes didn't dominate the entire thing, but she spoke as well. Joaquin Phoenix was best actor. Renée Zellweger was best actress, portraying Judy Garland, of course. Laura Dern, best supporting actress. Brad Pitt, who wasn't actually there, but he sent a message on video, best supporting actor for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
And yet again, there have been complaints about the lack of diversity at these awards.
Yes, and I have to say, I think those complaints are exactly justified, really. And the Oscars, don't forget, are only a week tonight. They're very close this year. Have exactly the same problem. There were pretty much no black or minority ethnic faces around at all in the main awards. It's something undoubtedly which the BAFTAs have to sort out. But the Oscars have the same problem. They've made a little bit more of progress in that there is one high profile actually black British actress, Cynthia Erivo, next week, who will be there at the Oscars, actually, rather embarrassingly, was not up for anything at the BAFTAs, even though she's from London. Overall, it was something which the cinema world seemed to be making progress with. I think the honest answer is that 2020 has been a bit of a step backwards.
Vincent Dowd. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.